Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Jonathan Evans and Dan Friedel talk about college educators coming together to defend free expression. Then, Brian Lynn brings us a story about a ban on pineapples and how it led to new food creations. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the education report.
About 200 college educators in the United States have formed a nonprofit organization called the Academic Freedom Alliance. On its website, the group says it aims to help college educators speak, instruct, and publish without fear of sanction or punishment. The nonprofit organization began out of discussions among some professors at Princeton University in the state of New Jersey. They wanted to find ways to fight against what they see as growing intolerance of differing opinions. The AFA plans to support those they believe have been unjustly attacked and provide money for legal support if needed.
Keith E. Whittington of Princeton University is head of the Alliance's Academic Committee. He said the group is looking for a way to advance a national discussion about free expression issues. He said the group wants to keep alive an idea called academic freedom, which was put forward by professors about 100 years ago. It has 3 points. The first is the freedom to teach without outside interference. The second is the ability to do research and write on academic issues without university leaders preventing the public from seeing the work. The third is the ability to speak in public about ideas of the day without interference from university leaders. Whittington said, "We still see all those things threatened at American colleges."
Whittington said college professors have been concerned for a long time about losing their jobs if they express ideas that might be unpopular with students, administrators, or people who give money to the school. Some college professors have had their jobs threatened for criticizing university presidents. "We still see faculty threatened for all those things now," he said. Whittington and the founders created the organization to offer some support to those professors. Some, he said, joined the group for that reason.
Whittington said a number of professors who joined the AFA were nervous at first about joining. Some, he said, were worried that their supporters would be concerned if they joined a group that had members who expressed opposing political opinions. But Whittington described the AFA as a genuinely cross-ideological group.
And it was somewhat difficult to persuade people that they ought to be out in front and standing up for these principles, even though sometimes that would mean defending speech that they found pretty unpleasant and very wrongheaded, and despite the fact that sometimes that would lead them to be personally criticized.
Whittington said the AFA seeks to fight against efforts to suppress and sanction professors who hold non-traditional or unpopular opinions.
But it's essential, I think, that we continue the struggle, that we continue to try to articulate what these principles are and why they're important, and we continue to try to defend individual professors who find themselves in the midst of these controversies.
Whittington said he hoped the AFA might start off with about 50 professors who could help spread their message. But the group received strong support and gained more members than that. The group will start by working for its members in case of controversy. But Whittington said it also wants to look out for non-members who may be involved in situations where support from the AFA might be helpful. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
And now, here is a story on pineapples from Brian Lin.
China began a ban on the import of pineapples from Taiwan on March 1st. The move led the Taiwanese government to begin a campaign urging its citizens to start eating more of the homegrown fruit. Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, even launched a social media challenge that called on people to eat the nation's pineapples until you burst. The calls are aimed at supporting the island's pineapple growers. Politicians from Taiwan's ruling Democratic Progressive Party and the opposition Nationalist Party visited farms and took pictures with pineapples and farmers to show their support. Taiwanese restaurant owners reacted to the ban by quickly trying to create new food offerings that contain pineapples. Some of the examples are pineapple shrimp balls and a nut and pineapple salad. Some existing dishes, like fried rice with pineapple, are also being offered more by restaurants and hotels on the island. Taipei cook Hung Ching Lung has created a pineapple beef noodle soup at his restaurant, Chef Hung. He says he and his team spent 3 days testing out ways to combine pineapple and beef noodles. It took about 10 attempts. The first time we tested it, when we cooked it in the soup, it was very sweet. It was inedible and tasted completely of pineapple, Hung told the Associated Press. But after many tries, the team learned it was best to separate the pineapple liquid during cooking, which removed an overpowering sweetness. China has said its pineapple ban was related to a pest issue and denies that it had anything to do with politics. Even with all the excitement in Taiwan, the pineapple ban may not hurt the country's farmers all that much. A day after the ban went into effect, Taiwanese Premier Tsu Tsung-Chang told local media the amount of pineapples that local businesses and citizens had bought was greater than the amount that would have been sold to China. Taiwan's government also promised assistance worth $35 million to help out farmers. And the government says it has received pineapple orders from Japan, Australia, Singapore, Vietnam, and some countries in the Middle East. It is unclear whether the increase in local orders and those from other nations will make up for China's ban in the long run. But for now, the move is causing some Taiwanese to feel patriotic. I'm Brian Lin.
And now, welcome to Words and Their Stories. On March 17th, in many places around the world, people celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Encyclopedia Britannica says St. Patrick is the patron saint of Ireland. Born in Roman Britain in the late 4th century, he was kidnapped at the age of 16 and taken to Ireland as a slave. He escaped but returned to convert the Irish to Christianity. Irish people and Irish-loving people everywhere celebrate St. Patrick's Day with religious services, parades, big meals, and even bigger parties. Decorations usually include green four-leaf clovers. The small plants are said to bring good luck. Another decoration is the leprechaun. A leprechaun is a troublemaking creature in old Irish stories. He looks like a very small man, and he knows where to find gold. Some experts say that in Irish folklore, it is believed that leprechauns can reveal the hiding places of treasures. The Encyclopedia Britannica explains that as far back as the 17th century, the Irish would say a person was as likely to find a pot of gold as to find the end of a rainbow. A colorful rainbow appears in the sky when the sun shines through water droplets. Keep in mind that there is no real end to a rainbow. And that brings us to our idiom, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. The pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is something you really want to have, or you really want to achieve. Finding your pot of gold at the end of a rainbow, or just pot of gold for short, feels like the realization of your hopes and dreams. For example, let's say someone loves animals and hopes to live out in the country. They could describe their pot of gold at the end of the rainbow as owning a working farm with cows, horses, dogs, and goats. Finding the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow can also be used to talk about actual money. When we use it this way, we usually mean that wealth has come suddenly. It means you have come into a huge windfall, which means a lot of money. For example, I found my pot of gold after winning the lottery. But sadly, that is just an example. However, finding your pot of gold may not be likely or even possible. Because of the unrealistic nature of the pot of gold, this expression is often used in the negative form. For example, A friend of mine was always unhappy. She moved a lot looking for happiness. Her father told her that she was looking for a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It doesn't exist, he warned. You must find a way to be happy wherever you are. But she ended up moving anyway. Some lessons we have to learn on our own. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. On a cold October day in 1957, the Soviet Union launched a small satellite into orbit around the Earth. Radio Moscow made the announcement.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
The world's first satellite was called Sputnik 1. Sputnik was an important propaganda victory for the Soviets in the Cold War with the United States. Many people believed the nation that controlled space could win any war, and the Soviet Union had reached outer space first. The technology that launched Sputnik probably began in the late 19th century. A Russian teacher of that time, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, decided that a rocket engine could provide power for a space vehicle. In the early 1900s, another teacher, American Robert Goddard, tested the idea. He experimented with small rockets to see how high and how far they could travel. In 1923, a Romanian student in Germany, Hermann Oberth, showed how a spaceship might be built and launched to other planets. Rocket technology improved during World War II. It was used to produce flying bombs. Thousands of people in Britain and Belgium died as a result of V-1 and V-2 rocket attacks. The rockets were launched from Germany. The larger V-2 rocket had the ability to hit the United States. After the war, it became clear that the United States and the Soviet Union, allies in wartime, would become enemies in peacetime. So both countries employed German scientists to help them win the race to space. The Soviets took the first step by creating Sputnik. This satellite was about the size of a basketball. It got its power from a rocket. It orbited Earth for 3 months. Within weeks, the Soviets launched another satellite into Earth orbit, Sputnik 2. It was much bigger and heavier than Sputnik 1. It also carried a passenger, a dog named Laika. The United States joined the space race about 3 months later. It launched a satellite from Cape Canaveral in the southeastern state of Florida. The satellite was called Explorer 1. It weighed about 14 kilograms. Explorer 1 went into a higher orbit than either Sputnik, and its instruments made an important discovery. They found an area of radiation about 960 kilometers above Earth. The next major space victory belonged to the Soviets. They sent the first man into space. In April 1961, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was launched in the vehicle known as Vostok. He remained in space for less than 2 hours. He landed safely by parachute near a village in Russia. Less than a month later, the United States sent its first astronaut into space. He was Alan Shepard. Shepard remained in space only about 15 minutes. He did not go into Earth orbit. That flight came in February 1962 with John Glenn. By 1965, the United States and the Soviet Union were experimenting to see if humans could survive outside a spacecraft. In March, Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov became the first person to do so. A strong tether connected Leonov to the spacecraft. The tether gave him oxygen to breathe, and it permitted him to float freely at the other end. After about 10 minutes, Leonov had to return to the spacecraft. He said he regretted the decision. He was having such a good time. A little more than 2 months later, an American would walk outside his spacecraft. Astronaut Edward White had a kind of rocket gun. This gave him some control of his movements in space. Like Leonov, White was sorry when he had to return to his spacecraft. Later that year, 1965, the United States tried to have one spacecraft get very close to another spacecraft while in orbit. This was the first step in getting spacecraft to link or dock together. Docking would be necessary to land men on the moon. The plan called for a Gemini spacecraft carrying two astronauts to get close to an unmanned satellite. The attempt failed. The target satellite exploded as it separated from its main rocket. America's space agency decided to move forward. It would launch the next in its Gemini series. Then someone had an idea. Why not launch both Geminis? The second one could chase the first one instead of a satellite. Again, things did not go as planned. It took two tries to launch the second Gemini. By that time, the first one had been in orbit about 11 days. Time was running out. The astronauts on the second Gemini moved their spacecraft into higher orbits. They got closer and closer to the Gemini ahead of them. They needed to get within 600 meters to be considered successful. After all the problems on the ground, the events in space went smoothly. The two spacecraft got within one-third of a meter of each other. The astronauts had made the operation seem easy. In January 1959, the Soviets launched a series of unmanned lunar rockets. The third of these flights took pictures of the far side of the moon. This was the side no one on Earth had ever seen. The United States planned to explore the moon with its unmanned Ranger spacecraft. There were a number of failures before Ranger 7 took pictures of the moon. These pictures were made from a distance. The world did not get pictures from the surface of the moon until the Soviet Luna 9 landed there in February 1966. For the next few years, both the United States and the Soviet Union continued their exploration of the moon. Yet the question remained, which one would be the first to put a man there? In December 1968, the United States launched Apollo 8 with three astronauts. The flight proved that a spacecraft could orbit the moon and return to Earth safely. The Apollo 9 spacecraft had two vehicles. One was the command module. It could orbit the moon, but could not land on it. The other was the lunar module. On a flight to the moon, it would separate from the command module and land on the moon's surface. Apollo 10 astronauts unlinked the lunar module and flew it close to the moon's surface. After those flights, everything was ready.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running.
On July 16, 1969, three American astronauts lifted off in Apollo 11. On the 20th, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin entered the lunar module called the Eagle. Michael Collins remained in the command module, the Columbia. The two vehicles separated.
25 feet, that's looking good, down a half.
It was a dangerous time. The Eagle could crash, or it could fall over after it landed. That meant the astronauts would die on the moon.
Forward, drift into the right level. 30 seconds forward.
Millions of people watched on television or listened on the radio. They waited for Armstrong's message.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. Then they waited again. It took the astronauts more than 3 hours to complete the preparations needed to leave the lunar module. Finally, the door opened. Neil Armstrong climbed down first. He put one foot on the moon, then the other foot, and then came his words from so far away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man on the moon. Oh, boy.
Boy. Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
CBS television newsman Walter Cronkite shared the excitement that he and so many people felt as man first walked on the surface of the moon. Later, Cronkite would remember the historical significance of that moment in 1969.
It was hard, I think, to imagine our emotions at the moment. It really was something that had to grip you. It was as if you could have stood at the dock and waved goodbye to Columbus. You knew darn good and well that this was the real history in the making.
Armstrong walked around. Soon, Aldrin joined him.
They're setting up the flag now.
The two men placed an American flag on the surface of the moon. They also collected moon rocks and soil. When it was time to leave, they returned to the Eagle and guided it safely away. They reunited with the Columbia and headed for home. The United States had won the race to the moon.
The thing that made this one particularly gripping was that there was that sense of history that if this was successful, this was a date that was going to be in all of the history books from time evermore. I think we sensed that at the time, just sitting there at the Cape and watching that great beast get on its way, that this was it.
Thank you.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.